I'd never read The Golden Notebook before, and in fact I'd read very little Doris Lessing, to my shame, but The Golden Notebook has always sort of sat in my consciousness, I suppose, as a book that I must at some point get round to reading, and I think it has a sort of iconic status still for our generation, you know, which I was aware of. So that's why I was delighted to be asked to do it, because it forced me to sit down and read this book I've always meant to read, go on this journey that I'd always meant to go on. And I think finishing the book for the first time, you do feel like you've been on this incredible journey through all sorts of different kinds of landscape, through a period, a time which I am too young to have lived through, but which I was conscious of coming up behind. And therefore it was an era that greatly influenced the period of my growing up and my young adulthood. I think the book takes you through what it was like to be alive at that time, if you were of a certain way of thinking and a way of being in the world, which is very visceral. It's not an academic exercise. It's extremely felt and inhabited. And also a journey internally into the state of mind and heart and being of Anna Wolfe, the protagonist. And then the match between those two, you know, the woman and the era she was living through. And you do feel at the end of it, you've been through this sort of extraordinary experience yourself. It really is like having watched an incredibly overpowering film or sat in the theatre for 3 hours. It's very intense feeling reading this book, and it's quite infiltrated my daily life, you know. It is possible to feel that the 50s are a distant era, and I think one of the surprises of the book is that people were already, and women in particular, obviously, I mean, women were already asking questions in many, many ways of their lives, which actually we are still asking now. I mean, many of those questions have found answers, and some of those answers have made their way into the fabric of our lives. But not by any means all, and for many women, not at all. So, two things, I think. One, first of all, that I'm surprised how similar some of the conversations between Anna and Molly, say, are to me, how familiar they are. Or certainly to my early adulthood, which was a long time after this. Secondly, the modernity of the book. I mean, I think the book still has a great deal to speak to women of our time. Because, of course, by definition, it's a book about a woman who has to divide herself into these four different notebooks in some way in order to kind of keep herself from disintegrating into this sort of morass, because she has her emotional sexual life, she has her creative professional life, she has her political life, belief systems, etc., and she has her life as a parent. And we all still juggle crazily with those different selves. We even are still, I think, questioning whether or not those are different selves or if they are one person. I'm very aware of becoming different kinds of Juliet at different times of my day or my week. And she talks about Anna Wolfe as different identities. You know, well, I completely connect to that. And I think lots and lots of women do. We're still trying to understand how to juggle those things and make sense of it and deal with all kinds of guilt as well in the process, which is a very female trait. Although the guilt may be of a different nature to the guilt of Anna Wolfe, which is very tied up with the death of that political ideology of the time and so on. I think it very much speaks still to our time, and if I'm surprised at anything, it's that it's not a historical piece. It's a book that women could read now and get an enormous amount out of. A fictional character has created another fictional character who in turn is writing a pastiche of something. So you've got layers and layers of identities in one moment. So whose voice are you using, for example? Whose voice is at the root of this pile-up of multiple identities? That's been quite challenging as we read it aloud. There are many, many interesting things about what Doris Lessing is doing, one of which is her phenomenal courage in going into every single area of this woman's life with almost no sense of sort of the need to be discreet or to sort of pay homage to certain mores. I mean, she's very bold in what she's exploring about, particularly Anna's sexuality, for example, and the places she takes that. I mean, very courageous and interesting, and she shines quite a clear, bright white light on those, unsentimentally on those areas of Anna's life that I've never really read before, you know, never seen written by anybody else. But I think what's really interesting is that she's very conscious of performance, you know, that Anna is performing Anna in different roles. Anna herself is conscious of Anna the mother, Anna the sexual partner, Anna the confused ex-communist. She's conscious of role-playing and performance, and partly that's why the book takes such a complicated form. Even in her writing, she tries performing her writing as some other writer. That's, you know, hence the parody or the pastiche. She's playing at identities in a way that's really, really interesting, quite ambitious and sometimes confusing, because I think she wrote this book in a white heat, as she said herself, and you very much get that impression when you're reading it, you know, that it pours out like this sort of lava torrent from this, you know, erupting volcano of the time. And in that lava, there is all sorts of, you know, heat and molten rock, and you trip and stumble your way through, but it's an amazingly kind of rich soup. And you don't really understand, even as you're reading it, you don't always understand what she's doing at any one particular moment. It's a cumulative thing, I think, as well. You know, it is a bit like a lava flow, actually. By the end of the book, suddenly, you know, the lava flow stops, and you look back and you see that the landscape has changed. But you're not necessarily aware of what it's doing moment by moment. But I think what's really interesting for me, you know, growing up at a time where I did have a sort of very strong left-wing ideology and had to come to terms with having to move, as we all have, into an era where there is no alternative ideology, really, to capitalism, or there is, coming up from the grassroots. But that the death of the sort of dream of egalitarianism and of a different world that socialism generated. But for her, living in this period, for this protagonist, Anna Wolf, you know, she had to really deal with that split in a very, very intense and life-changing way, having been a member of the Communist Party. And then the end of that era and the realization of the horrors of Stalin's regime being revealed and the knowledge that that Soviet experiment had failed so cruelly and so horrifically, for whatever reason, but that failed. And so the character's split between her head and her heart is very extreme. So you get a heart that is still committed to the notion of an equal society and fairness and compassion and justice and the need to align your life behind that, but a head that tells you that experiment in its known form has failed globally, you know, and in a very, very sort of brutal way. And so people living at that time, I think, experienced this split in themselves much more keenly than we have. That's partly why she falls to pieces. She is literally sort of fragmented by this. I think it's something that we can all understand, though, but you see it in a much more extreme form at this time and in this character. The Golden Notebook by Doris Lessing, read by Juliet Stevenson. Free Women 1. Anna meets her friend Molly in the summer of 1957 after a separation. The two women were alone in the London flat.
"The point is," said Anna, as her friend came back from the telephone on the landing, "the point is that, as far as I can see, everything's cracking up."
Molly was a woman much on the telephone. When it rang, she had just inquired, "Well, what's the gossip?" Now she said, "That's Richard, and he's coming over. It seems today is his only free moment for the next month, or so he insists."
"Well, I'm not leaving," said Anna.
"No, you stay just where you are."
Molly considered her own appearance. She was wearing trousers and a sweater, both the worse for wear.
"He'll have to take me as I come," she concluded, and sat down by the window. "He wouldn't say what it's about. Another crisis with Marion, I suppose."
"Didn't he write to you?" asked Anna, cautious.
"Both he and Marion wrote. Ever such bonhomous letters. Odd, isn't it?"
This "odd, isn't it?" was the characteristic note of the intimate conversations they designated gossip. But having struck the note, Molly swerved off with, "It's no use talking now because he's coming right over, he says."
"He'll probably go when he sees me here," said Anna, cheerfully but slightly aggressive.
Molly glanced at her keenly and said,
"Oh, but why?"
It had always been understood that Anna and Richard disliked each other, and before, Anna had always left when Richard was expected. Now Molly said,
"Actually, I think he rather likes you, in his heart of hearts. The point is, he's committed to liking me, on principle. He's such a fool, he's always got to either like or dislike someone, so all the dislike he won't admit he has for me gets pushed off onto you."
"It's a pleasure," said Anna.
"But you know something? I discovered, while you were away, that for a lot of people, you and I are practically interchangeable." "You've only just understood that?" said Molly, triumphant, as always, when Anna came up with, as far as she was concerned, facts that were self-evident. In this relationship, a balance had been struck early on.
Molly was altogether more worldly wise than Anna, who, for her part, had a superiority of talent. Anna held her own private views. Now she smiled, admitting that she'd been very slow.
"When we're so different in every way," said Molly. "It's odd. I suppose because we both live the same kind of life, not getting married and so on. That's all they see."
"Free women," said Anna, wryly. She added, with an anger new to Molly, so that she earned another quick, scrutinizing glance from her friend, "They still define us in terms of relationships with men, even the best of them."
"Well, we do, don't we?" said Molly, rather tart. "Well, it's awfully hard not to," she amended hastily, because of the look of surprise Anna now gave her.
There was a short pause, during which the women did not look at each other, but reflected that a year apart was a long time, even for an old friendship.